I'm Phoebe White from the U.S. Rates Strategy Team at J.P. Morgan. You're listening to At Any Rate, our global research podcast, where we take a look at the story behind some of the biggest trends, themes, and industries in markets today. We're unfortunately not in the studio today, but joining me here on the phone, we have Mike Feroli, Alex Rover, Jay Barry, and Josh Younger to talk about the rapid and aggressive responses we've seen from the Fed in an attempt to limit the economic fallout from the COVID-19 pandemic and to ensure that markets continue to function. So, Mike, let's start with you. Could you talk about the actions the Fed has taken so far and maybe how they've been different from the 2008 crisis response?
All right. So I think if I tried to summarize everything the Fed did over the last 2 weeks, it would take up the entirety of the podcast. So I'll just speak broadly. I think they did two groups of actions. One is monetary policy, and the second are actions meant to unfreeze or repair broken or poorly functioning financial markets. On the monetary policy front, which is the easy part, arguably the only action that they've really done recently that's monetary policy has been to lower the policy interest rate, the Fed funds rate, to 0 to 25 basis points and putting IOER at 10 basis points. And they did give some weak forward guidance that it's likely to remain there for quite some time. But then really, I think almost everything else they have done has been geared toward helping financial markets that have been functioning poorly. And this includes, actually, I think, a lot of the asset purchases that they've been doing recently. Whereas in the 2008 to 2013 period, those asset purchases were designed to put downward pressure on longer term interest rates and thereby stimulate economic growth, and that being monetary policy. This time around, I think it was really more about returning more normal functioning in those markets. And then, of course, they did a whole variety of programs meant to support various markets like those for commercial paper and corporate credit. And again, I think going through the list of those actions might be a bit time consuming, but they were creative, they were aggressive, and they were done with speed. I think in terms of what is different from 2008, you know, I think it's been common to remark that 2008 was a financial event that morphed into the real economy. And this is a real economy event that's morphing into a financial one. Either way, we're kind of getting to the same place, which is a lot of stress in markets. And so, you know, it's easy to say what's similar to 2008, which is a lot of the same facilities have been brought out without any or very little modification. So the primary dealer credit facility, corporate paper facility. So a lot of those things are similar. Probably the difference is the speed with which they have moved. So the Fed's first 13-3 action in 2008 was in March of 2008 around the Bear Stearns event. And their last one was in March of 2009, the TALF, which another facility that they've reintroduced. So whereas it took a year to unveil all those 13-3 facilities, they've done all that and more in this current episode. And by more, including corporate credit in particular. So it's similar, but it is it's larger, it's more aggressive, and it has come on faster.
Great. So Jay, let's talk about the asset purchases. I mean, now the Fed is buying $75 billion per day, so that's far outstripping the pace we saw in the past QE programs. Can you put that in context for us?
Yeah, thanks, Phoebe. Mike's already mentioned that this is being done at a sort of a stunning pace, and I think you can use the same analogy when you're talking about the Fed's purchases of treasuries. Since the Fed ramped up its daily purchases to $75 billion, it's been buying about $50 billion 10-year treasury equivalents on a daily basis. To put this in context, during the Fed's four prior sets of QE programs, QE 1, 2, and 3, as well as Operation Twist, it was only purchasing anywhere between $1 billion and $3 billion in 10-year treasury equivalents per day. So this pace that we're observing every day is anywhere between 15 and 25 times the run rate we saw from 2009 through 2014. One other way to consider this is the Fed announced that it would purchase at least $500 billion in treasuries when it made its first announcement Sunday night a week and a half ago. With what the Fed has purchased so far and projecting to purchase through the end of this week, the Fed will likely buy close to $650 billion in treasuries over just a two-week period. So the pace of purchases is, calling it a record would be an understatement, to be fair.
And so what do you think? Are these purchases having the intended effect of improving market functioning? And how can we measure the impacts that they're having?
Yes, I think we can definitively say that they are having a major impact on the Treasury market. As Mike mentioned, this QE program more closely resembles QE1, where it was aimed at reducing dislocations rather than bringing down long-term rates. And we can see that in what's happened. Because at the root here, what has occurred is, broadly speaking, we have seen a major amount of dislocations come into the market for financing intensive off-the-run treasuries, which trade with a fraction of the notional with which on-the-runs trade on a daily basis, but make up the bulk of the market in the treasuries market. So if we can look at a number of measures, we think the best broad measure is our root mean square error of our par-fitted treasury curve, which really measures the dispersion of yields along the treasury curve. This measure had averaged 1.1 basis points or so for the 2 years leading up until this month, but then basically tripled over the course of a week leading up to the Fed's first purchase announcement to 3 basis points. At 3 basis points, this was the highest level we had seen in about a decade. Since then, as the Fed has sort of done and committed to the markets to do whatever it takes, our RMSE has dropped back to 2 basis points. So retracing about 50% of the move we saw earlier this month. On a smaller scale, we can observe this sort of dislocation and dispersion and off the runs when we look at the relationship in between on the run treasuries and very near off the runs that were auctioned but a few months ago. So to put it in context, looking at match maturity asset swap spread between current 10 and 30 years and triple olds, we see that the spreads on those securities on the runs outperform their near or off the run counterparts by 5 to 6 basis points over the course of just 2 weeks earlier this month, prior to the Fed's action. Since the Fed has stepped in to start these aggressive purchases and increase the pace, those spreads have retraced a bit more than 50% of the way. So they're not quite back at normal in any sort of measure that we've looked about, but we are sharply improved from where we were just a week ago or so. And in aggregate, when we look at RMSE or on the run, off the run spreads, it shows about 50% improvement. But if there's one place that's lagged, it's been the very long end of the curve. And that makes sense to us, because if we look at where the biggest buildup in dealer inventory occurred, and likely where the biggest liquidations occurred from end users, that was at the long end, and that's where dealer positions had doubled in the early part of March. So while the Fed continues to sort of purchase significant amounts of debt across the curve that are representative of the total outstanding treasury market, given that the bulk of the liquidations occurred at the long end, it's probably going to take some time to clean this up. And that's where we've seen a bit of a slower reversion back to normal. But overall, we've seen a sharp improvement in our dispersion measure and a little bit of a reduced preference for liquidity vis-a-vis on the run versus near off the run spreads.
Okay, so some more work for them to do, but I think we can safely say that we're seeing signs of improvement in the treasury market. Alex, what about the repo market? What has the usage been in those repo operations and what impacts have they been having?
Yeah, so the Fed has ramped up its repo operations in support of promoting liquidity within the treasury markets. As Jay referenced, there was a lot of buildup in dealer inventory that was very hard to sort of work through. So from a financial stability standpoint, you know, one of the things that was important for the Fed to do was to keep making sure that funding was available for the primary dealer community and the people that they support. So we did see the sum total of repos provided by the Fed peak about a week ago at just under $500 billion. And since that time, we've seen, the outstandings in the repo market drop by close to $150 billion from there. So it stands around 350 right now. So that's a pretty significant improvement, although 350 is a very elevated level. We believe, in keeping with sort of what Mike has suggested, that the Fed will continue to do whatever they need to do to ensure that the market is functioning in treasuries.
Okay, and what about short-term credit? Can you talk through some of the various funding facilities that the Fed has launched and what impacts they're having?
Sure. In addition to what the Fed's done for treasuries, they've been aggressive, I think, about trying to roll out programs to deal with dislocations in credit markets. So early last week, they talked about introducing three different facilities. One targeted at the money market fund, so that would be the money market liquidity facility. One targeted at commercial paper issuers, that would be the commercial paper funding facility. And one targeted at primary dealers, primary dealer credit facility. As we record this on Wednesday of this week, two of those facilities are up and running now. The money market liquidity facility, the MMLF, became operational earlier this week, and essentially is allowing dealers to buy in the secondary market qualifying paper that they can then put into the Fed's program to create liquidity in the marketplace and free up balance sheet for them to trade more money market securities. Importantly, between the time that the idea was introduced and the operation began, they included a wider range of securities. So we do think that this is going to be a fairly effective tool in helping the money markets to return to some level of normality. The primary dealer credit facility has also become operative. It became operative late last week. And so what that does is it allows dealers to work with a variety of different asset classes, rates, and credit products, and use the Fed's lending to help support those markets. The big one that's sort of missing so far is the commercial paper funding facility. There was an FAQ that was just recently released, and it indicated in the FAQ that the facility, the CPFF facility, would become operational sometime during the first half of April 2020. So, that's could be, a few weeks out. And unfortunately, that seems like a very long time to take for a market that's under pretty significant stress right now. It's also kind of curious, given the fact that this was a program that was operative in 2008. So they've run it before, and it really shouldn't be operationally that difficult for them to get off the ground. So it's a little curious why that's taking that long. They also earlier this week announced the creation of several other facilities, and notably one of those would be the TALF, which is a asset-backed lending facility, which covers a lot of sort of higher quality securitized products. And then there are two other facilities that target more credit-sensitive securities. So one is the primary market corporate credit facility, the PMCCF, and the secondary market corporate credit facility. In a news release yesterday, there was a notation that a large asset manager had been retained to operate those facilities on behalf of the Federal Reserve. So hopefully those facilities will be up and running and providing credit on a new issue basis and on a secondary market basis in the not too distant future. So I guess the other question we've been getting asked is with all these programs that the Fed has introduced, what's still missing? And there are sort of, I think, some significant omissions in the menu of what they're offering here, particularly in the securitized products area. A vast majority of the fixed income market, will get some relief. If not currently, they will get it eventually. But the private mortgage market, both the residential and commercial side, have not really received any such support. And they are facing, massive delevering from REITs, originators, hedge funds, and others. There's probably about $1.9 trillion of securitized products under liquidity stress right now. And so when we look at certain corners of the market, things like senior AAA jumbo MBS are trading at very wide levels. Non-government supported CMBS are under a lot of stress. CLO AAAs are under tremendous stress. So you can really sort of see these in their spreads. So that's an area where I think we'll have to see the Federal Reserve come back and potentially do some more work. One of the things they could do is reintroduce the PIP program, or something like the PIP program from 2008, which is a public-private investor partnership, which helped to provide liquidity to some of these some of these more distant corners of the securitized products market.
So, Josh, what do you think? Are there other ways the Fed can reduce intermediation frictions and stop this delevering cycle?
So they have a few options. The key here is whether we address the root causes of the delevering cycle itself, or if we try to address some of its symptoms. So on the one hand, bank balance sheets have been a significant cause of a lot of this stress, and simply the fact that most assets count at the same level for leverage ratios and other requirements like G-SIB, that makes it harder to take on inventory as a market maker. So the reason why Treasuries were the epicenter of what became and is increasingly becoming a credit crisis is largely a result of the fact that the treasuries took up too much balance sheet and left less balance sheet for intermediation in other markets. So one approach here is to address banks' need for liquidity by allowing them to raise it, and that's softening liquidity ratio coverage requirements. That makes sense conceptually simply because the rationale for that rule was for banks to hold high-quality liquid assets that they could easily monetize to meet draws on their liquidity. And that's precisely the scenario that we have now. What the rule did not envision is a liquidity crisis that starts in the high-quality liquid asset market. So for banks to raise liquidity to meet any demands that they're facing, any demands for cash, by selling high-quality liquid assets like treasuries, that really just exacerbates the problem. So that's not really a viable solution here. The alternative would be to allow them to either release excess capital, or more importantly, or more effectively, to change what we mean by leverage calculation. And so one approach that's been discussed, though not necessarily in any way put forward by the Fed, but certainly discussed by those in the market, is the idea of carving out risk-free assets from various leverage requirements. And that includes the supplementary leverage ratio and, in principle, things like G-SIB and other binding constraints or economic constraints on bank activity, simply because banks hold so much of that type of asset, both for liquidity coverage ratio purposes and in their market making through repo and simple market making and treasuries, that would relieve them of a tremendous amount of balance sheet cost in the form of their leverage ratio. And especially if G-SIB were to scope out those risk-free assets, cash and treasuries, potentially agency MBS, particularly those with an explicit government guarantee, that would just create a lot more room for banks to make markets. It's not quite so straightforward as that simply because that's a big change to the incentive structure that banks face. So it's not quite so straightforward as waving a wand, but it is something that is within the toolkit of the Fed to do.
So how quickly could these kinds of changes get done?
So under normal circumstances, this is a whole comment and proposal process, which takes months, if not years, to do from start to finish. And that's putting out an initial proposal, having that proposal, soliciting comments on that proposal, evaluating those comments, reproposing potentially, and eventually issuing a final rule with an implementation timeline. Under these circumstances, there is some precedent, even recently, for the issuance of interim final rules, which implement changes rather quickly. So in principle, these types of things are doable, but again, it is a rather invasive change to the supervisory structure, and in that sense, would be something the Fed would think very carefully about doing.
Okay, I want to turn to the fiscal response. As we're recording this, it seems Congress is pretty close to passing its stimulus bill, so clearly there's going to need to be a lot of Treasury supply. Jay, how much additional debt will Treasury need to issue this year, and how well-positioned are they to raise these funds given the current issuance calendar?
Sure. Well, I think the first thing I'd say is that we've been revising our deficit and issuance forecasts at a speed that we've never seen before and barely been able to keep up. So currently, we're forecasting a $1.7 trillion budget deficit in fiscal 20 and $1.5 trillion in fiscal 21. But that was assuming a fiscal stimulus package of about $1 trillion in size. Clearly, what we're hearing from the agreement between Democratic and Republican leadership in the Senate is that that number is closer to $2 trillion in size, so doubling what we were originally assuming. Nevertheless, using our current forecast, we're looking for about $1.9 trillion in net Treasury issuance this year, which would be a substantial increase from what we saw last year alone. And this is an historic sort of change in pace of Treasury issuance, but it's not necessarily unprecedented. So the question is how quickly can the Treasury ramp up its borrowing capacity? What are the tools it has, and how can it make use of those? First, we'd need to look to the Treasury bill market, which is, from a structural perspective and a seasonal perspective, the shock absorber for Treasury supply. So when Treasury needs to ramp up Treasury issuance, it at first tends to do so in the bill market. And that makes sense in the context of this fiscal package, particularly when it sounds like some of these initiatives involve one-time payments to citizens and to taxpayers. We saw something similar in the fall of 2008 when the TARP program was passed. And at that time, the T-bill market increased in size by $800 billion, or about a 60% increase over just a three-month span. So we think, at least at onset, the bill market will bear the brunt of the increase in these issuance. But after that, it's going to require more term financing as well, because the size of the deficit is much larger than we'd expected. And we also know that even before this potential recession, that the Treasury had a pretty large financing, a gap to address over the future years. So in 2008, this meant that Treasury added off-cycle reopenings to 10-year notes and 30-year bonds. It also brought back the 7-year note as well. This time around, fortunately, we've got the 20-year bond waiting in the wings. If you recall, in late January, that the Treasury reintroduced the 20-year with an intention to begin auctioning the security in May. So we think this security can have up to about $250 billion in borrowing capacity per annum. And as Treasury needs to increase its auction sizes, it will lean heavily on this. And in fact, we've heard in commentary from the Treasury Secretary that he does want to lean heavily on long-term issuance as well. So all in, we think that we're going to see bills bear the brunt of this over the sort of first couple of months. And right now, our forecasts incorporate $395 billion in T-bill net issuance in the second quarter. But again, we think this is being understated given the announcement of what we're expecting on the fiscal side. And then we're looking for the 20-year to sort of ramp up thereafter from May onward. But given the scope of the financing need that Treasury will have in the coming months and in the coming years, we think this is going to mean it's going to need to increase auction sizes elsewhere in the nominal space, because it's really bills and nominals that bear the brunt of this. And then over time, as deficits stabilize, we'd expect to see more of that come into the TIPS market as well.
Thanks, Jay. To our listeners, thank you for joining us. Institutional clients of JP Morgan can find more on these topics on JP Morgan Markets at jpmm.com or reaching out to us directly with questions. Stay tuned for more episodes of At Any Rate, JP Morgan's Global Research Podcast series. This communication is provided for information purposes only. Please read JP Morgan research reports related to its contents for more information, including important disclosures. Copyright 2020. JP Morgan Chase & Co. All rights reserved. This episode was recorded on March 25th, 2020.